Miss Diane. On My Mind, an interview I did with poet Billy Collins last November. We wanted to share it again in recognition of National Poetry Month. When the pandemic began, the former U.S. Poet Laureate started live streaming himself on Facebook, reading his own poems and some favorites written by others. It struck a chord with fans who now tune in daily. This isn't too surprising. For decades, Collins has held the unique title of best-selling poet. His work often examines the everyday, the domestic, the personal. Now 79, Collins has just published his 14th poetry collection titled Whale Day. In it, he turns his attention to mortality. But the poems are not morose. They're filled with Collins' signature humor and an overwhelming sense of gratitude. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Billy Collins, it's great to see you and to have you here for this day after Thanksgiving and to tell you how much I love your new book of poetry called Whale Day. Tell me why you have called this book Whale Day.
Well, you might wonder. It's kind of an odd title. Diane, the thing is that when I title a book, I'm not someone who goes through the whole all the poems and tries to think of the big theme that ties it all together. So I don't have titles that are kind of a key to the book. Like, what I do is I look at the table of contents or I look at all the poems I have, and I just pick the one that would seem interesting on a cover of a book. And I think of it as a commodity among other things. And then I look for cover art to go with it. And I've been very lucky with Random House. I've been with them for 14 years, I think. And they've let me choose all my cover art and let me in on the design of the typeface and everything. So it's a real creative process for me to make a book with their help, of course.
I wonder if you would begin by reading for us the function of poetry, the poem that actually begins your new book.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a very promising title. It's a big title, but you'll see that it's a very small poem. And I put it in the book as a kind of prefatory poem. The function of poetry. I woke up early on a Tuesday, made a pot of coffee for myself, then drove down to the village, stopping at the post office, then the bank where I cashed a little check from a magazine. And when I got home, I read some of the newspaper, starting with the science section, and had another cup of coffee and a bowl of cereal. Pretty soon it was lunchtime, but I wasn't at all hungry. But I paused for a moment to look out the big kitchen window. And that's when I realized that the function of poetry is to remind me that there is much more to life than what I am usually doing when I'm not reading or writing poetry.
Tell me about that feeling when you had that realization.
Well, I think I was thinking of behind the poem, I think, is a comment by Seamus Heaney when he said, I'm not a poet all the time. You know, I'm going to the store or I'm engaged in something else. I'm a poet some of the time. So we're really not poets more than we are poets. We spend more time not being poets, that is to say, we're not writing. And then I just thought of my routine. It's a very routine. The first stanza is supposed to be very dull. I mean, this is what I do. I go to the post office. Maybe I go to the bank. I have another cup of coffee. And it's almost enough to put you to sleep. But it does come to this realization as I'm looking out the window that this is the function of poetry to remind me that there's more to life than what I'm doing when I'm not writing poetry. So it's saying that I'm best when I'm reading or writing poetry. That's when I'm connected to life more than when I'm running errands.
You know, I had the feeling, reading through many of these poems, that another thing that's on your mind these days is mortality. Your poem, Life Expectancy, made me think of that early on in the book, and there seem to be several examples like that. Life expectancy is on page 10. Would you read that for us, and then let's talk about it.
Okay, I'd be happy to. Life expectancy. On the morning of a birthday that ended in a zero, I was looking out at the garden when it occurred to me that the robin on her worm hunt in the dewy grass had a good chance of outliving me, as did the worm itself, for that matter, if he managed to keep his worm head down. It was not always like this. For decades, I could assume that I would be around longer than the squirrel dashing up a tree or the nightly raccoons in the garbage, longer than the barred owl on a branch, the ibis, the chicken, and the horse, longer than four deer in a clearing, and every creature in the zoo, except the elephant and the giant tortoise, whose cages I would hurry past. It was just then in my calculations that the cat padded noiselessly into the room, and it seemed reasonable, given her bright eyes and glossy coat, to picture her at my funeral, dressed all in black as usual, which would nicely set off her red collar. Some of the mourners might pause in their grieving to notice, as she found a place next to a labradoodle in a section of the church reserved for their kind.
So I love the ending of the picture of that cat dressed in black with a touch of red sitting next to the labradoodle reserved for their kind. I just love that. So there's humor in this, but there's also that sense of one's own mortality.
Well, I think in many of these poems, I'm trying to blend that. And of course, I'm not the first poet to talk about mortality. I think it's probably the oldest theme in poetry, going back to Roman poetry and the theme of carpe diem, that we must seize the day. We must seize the day because we don't have all the diems in the world. So the sense of an awareness of mortality tends to intensify life rather than a morbid fascination with it. But yeah, I think there are only a few themes in poetry, a handful of themes, and certainly the idea that death making more sense of life than usual is one of them. I think, who was it? Kafka, I think, was asked, what is the meaning of life? And he said, the meaning of life is that it ends. So that's a rather abrupt definition. One of the milestones in being aware of death, I think someone said, if once your dentist is younger than you are, that's one thing to notice that as you're aging. And I think we always assume, like if we see a squirrel or something, you know, they have a shorter life than we do, and robins and birds and insects and all that. But at a certain point, you can't be that sure. And so that this is taking a new angle at this ancient theme.
And 2020 with the COVID virus, of course, you wrote that poem, I believe, long before we were afflicted with the COVID virus. But nevertheless, that must be very much on your mind these days.
Well, not only that, there is a, I've written a couple of poems in response to the COVID, very short ones. And there's also a book edited by Alice Quinn called Together in a Sudden Strangeness, America's Poets Respond to the Pandemic. And if you'd like to hear those two little poems.
I'd love to.
Okay. This is just called Nurse. The one who spoke by a window in a stairwell, resting her head on her arm, said she was so many stumbles beyond tired, she caught herself envying the dead for looking like sleepers in their beds. And then the other little one is only six lines long, and it takes It takes off from an image in a poem by Shelley called Ode to the West Wind. I'm kind of explaining it, but it's all about wind. And he notices the wind blowing these leaves on the ground, and they're all different colors. And he calls them pestilence-stricken multitudes, as if these are people fleeing a plague, pestilence-stricken multitudes. I've never been able to get that image out of my head. So here's the little poem called Comparisons. In Ode to the West Wind, Shelley calls a scattering of blown leaves pestilence-stricken multitudes. And now we are the stricken with no place to scatter, and this year's leaves have begun to fall.
Well, it's so short, but so profound in terms of what we are all feeling these days. I walk my dog through the falling leaves, and I too am thinking, I wonder how many more times I will see those falling leaves.
I have a poem in which I talk about, you know, how many Octobers do I have? Like a box of Octobers or a suitcase full of Aprils? Once you start thinking about death, there's all sorts of ways of measuring it or looking at it.
How many hours each day do you spend writing, or is it that you wait for that poem to come to you?
Well, it's both. I think one develops a habit of kind of paying attention to things with the hope of finding something in an everyday experience that will provoke a poem. And the little poem called Nurse came from something on television. It was a nurse with her head down in a stairwell in a hospital, saying that she was ashamed of herself, that she envied the dead. That's how tired she was. So I just organized that in a couple of stanzas. But sometimes I don't write every day, Diane, but I do. I'm confessing this to you. But I do often just get up and sit in a chair with a cup of coffee and see what happens. I'll often read somebody else's poems, read poems by William Matthews or James Tate or Marie Howe or Charles Simic. So I do sit down and open a notebook and see what happens. And if nothing happens, it doesn't. But so it's kind of a combination of being passively ready to receive an idea for a poem, and also getting in a kind of irregular habit of sitting down and asking for something to come in.
Actually, when the pandemic began, I gather you started streaming a poem a day on Facebook. What did you hope to do by doing that?
Well, it was really my wife's idea, and I think she just wanted to keep me busy and stop bothering her all the time. But it was March 23rd. It was the day after my birthday, and I had just come back from New York, and the virus was just taking hold in America, especially in the East Coast. And she's a great follower of Facebook. I have never participated myself, but never say never. She said, you know, if you got on Facebook, you could just read a poem or two and it would be something to do. And she said, let's decide a time. I said, 5:30. We'll do it at cocktail time.
Good.
The first one lasted 8 minutes. I don't remember what I said, but I read a couple of poems and said goodbye. Now it's about a half an hour. And what happens is I'll play some music, usually some jazz, and I'll put on some cool looking shades and talk about the song I just played. And that's my Professor Bebop role. And then they make comments, and hundreds of comments and thousands of listeners at this point. And I go through the comments and see if any interesting ones, and there are lots of interesting ones. So I have a mailbag, kind of like an old radio show. And I read some comments from the mailbag, and then I read poems. Mostly my own in the beginning, but now all sorts of other people's poems. And then I play a little music at the end, and that's it. So it does give me something to do. It's every weekday. It started every day. We just call it the Poetry Broadcast, and it's on Billy Collins's Facebook page. Anybody can jump in there. Diane, we have people from all over the world listening. I'll give you one little summary of that. There's a woman in Paris who tucks herself in and goes to sleep listening to the broadcast. Another woman in Australia listens with her morning coffee. So it's in all sorts of time zones.
That must really give you a great deal of satisfaction to know that people around the world have come to rely on that half hour. Whatever is being read, whether it's your poetry or someone else's.
Well, Diane, I said right in the beginning, I remember this in the very first broadcast, I said, I'm not going to read poems to comfort you or make you feel better about yourself. It's not that kind of, I'm just going to read good poems. And so it's not that kind of sentimental comforting of the audience, but they say it's not the news. And I say, I'll never mention the news. And, you know, there's so many things going on in this country at this time. It's amazing. And I said, this it's being thought of now as kind of an oasis from the news, something to hear that is not mentioning what's going on. It's mentioning more important things like life and death that will always be going on. Not as Ezra Pound said, poetry is the news that stays new.
And of course, into that mix comes a lot of humor. And as I mentioned earlier with your reference to the cat draped in black and the labradoodle going to a place for their kind, is there an intention to bring that kind of lightness to that heavy subject of aging?
Well, yeah, I think it's part of my sensibility. I think if one tries to be funny, it's going to fail. And some people want to write humorous poems, but they're not really humorous people. And you can't really put on funny. You know, you can pretend to be serious, right, Diane? You and I are sort of pretending to be serious right now, but you can't pretend to be funny. You're either funny or you're not funny. So even though humor is thought of as kind of lower level or like unserious poetry, it can be used to access very many serious things in life. But it's very authentic in that you can't fake it.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Billy Collins. We recorded this last November.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with poet Billy Collins from this past November. You have a poem in this book about your parents, and I gather in many ways your mother was your first poetry teacher. Can you read us that poem and then tell us about your parents?
Is this the convergence poem?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. The convergence of my parents. This morning, I am looking out my window at a crowd of white irises, imagining that I am my mother in 1934, looking out the window of her train, the one she rode from Toronto to Los Angeles to work as a nurse in Queen of Angels Hospital. Only her train has stopped outside a little town somewhere in the Midwest, and she is looking out at the irises in someone's garden. Around that time, maybe my young father from Massachusetts was riding another train from Boston to Galveston to work as an electrician on an offshore oil rig. a man who was more likely to be reading a newspaper than admiring the flowers in a stranger's garden, but who must have spent some time looking out at the scenery, wondering about himself, and maybe a field of wildflowers went flashing by. I wouldn't be here looking at irises or anything else had they not found each other years later, the non-parallel lines of their lives meeting in New York, where I was born, because I wanted to be close to my mother, as my father liked to joke. She was still a nurse, and he was her patient. He had been struck on the forehead by a tool a coworker had mishandled. And that is the story of how I got here, how I pulled out of the first station of my life. So there I'm using this train metaphor. And both of my parents, they didn't marry till they were in their very late 30s. They met in a hospital in New York, where he was her patient. My father was from Lowell, Massachusetts. My mother was born at a kind of farming town 100 miles north of Toronto. And he became an electrician. She became a nurse, which allowed them to go anywhere. And for some reason, they both had this wanderlust, and they traveled around the country, mostly by train. My mother going as far as Los Angeles to work in a hospital there. And she also worked for a rich woman who took her up to Banff and Lake Louise. And she traveled all over. She was really a kind of proto-feminist, going out on her own, sometimes traveling with a nurse friend. And my father was doing the same thing, crisscrossing the country, working as an electrician. He worked on the Empire State Building. He worked in the Daily News print room on oil rigs in Gulf of Mexico. And somehow, I mean, I suppose if you think back at anybody considering their parents, had they not met, clearly you would not be here. So, usually people meet by coincidence, you know, walk into a party, you happen to be at this restaurant. And I suppose it would be interesting for anyone to think back on how their parents met and kind of give thanks for that moment of a serendipity.
But your father was actually in a hospital and your mother was the nurse?
Yes.
And that's how they met?
That's how they met. It was, they call it the felis culpa in Christianity, the happy fall. If Adam had not eaten the apple, we wouldn't have Christ. So it was a happy accident that this tool hit my father in the forehead and he had to go to the hospital.
And there she was.
It just does show you how strangely coincidental life is. And people going to college, they think this is very, very vital to pick the right college. And it really, you know, if you end up at a not such a great college, that's where you might meet your wife and have three great children and all that. So no one thing gives you control over the rest of your life, I wouldn't think.
I want to ask you a little more about your mother. I gather she taught you how to read. She inculcated a love of reading language in you.
She did read to me all the time, which I consider one of the great things you can do in life is read to a young person, parent or no parent. And she learned a lot of poetry when she was a schoolgirl in Canada. And memorization back then was not only a legitimate way to teach poetry, it was probably the only way to teach poetry. Students were made to memorize and get into the rhythm of poetry. But she wasn't a literary person. She was smart and she read a lot of British and Scottish history. But she had a lot of Shakespeare in her head and she would quote poems on a regular basis. And I was hearing poetry, Diane, before I knew it was poetry. I knew that my mother had two ways of talking. One was the regular way and the other was the poetry way. And it was like, I knew the poetry way was better or different. And looking back, it was a little like AM and FM radio. And the poetry was FM and the regular was AM.
I wonder if you'd read another poem for us called Sleeping on My Side.
Of course. This is a poem that turned out to be a sonnet. I always try to listen to my poem and not just force upon the poem what I want to say. Sometimes the poem develops its own whimsy. And about six lines into this, the poem seemed to be saying it wanted to be a sonnet. So I said to the poem, well, I'm not going to go back and rewrite the whole thing, but I'll turn you into a sonnet from this point on. It's called Sleeping on My Side. Every night, no matter where I am, when I lie down, I turn my back on half the world. At home, it's the East I ignore, with its theaters and silverware, as I face the adventurous West. But when I'm out on the road, in some hotel's room, 213 or 402, I could be pointed anywhere, yet I hardly care, as long as you are there, facing the other way. So we are defended in all degrees, and my left ear is pressing down as if listening for hoofbeats in the ground. So that's very much the American East and the American West. It's almost a 19th century poem because the West is full of adventure and the East is sophistication, silverware, theaters, and that kind of thing. That's why the poem ends with me with my left ear always the ones down as if listening for hoofbeats in the ground the way the Lone Ranger used to.
Would you call that a love poem, Billy?
Yeah, it becomes a love poem. And that's another thing about the poem. It didn't start out as a love poem. I like poems that kind of turn into love poems. I'd say love and death are kind of the, if you can have two magnetic norths, that's where poems tend to go, toward love or toward death as the two big subjects. And it's not until the end when I say, yet I hardly care as long as you are there. And that's the first time any you is mentioned. And then the loved one faces the other way. So we're defended in all degrees, like we're looking out for danger in all degrees and listening for hoofbeats. So it takes a kind of, it's from, you know, watching too many Westerns, I guess.
You were poet laureate during the time of 9/11, and you wrote the poem, The Names. I wonder if you could talk about that experience when you first read it and then read it for us.
Okay, be happy to. Well, I was named Poet Laureate after, I think it was June of 2001, so it was just a few months before 9/11. And there was a kind of an anniversary or memorial one year after the attacks, when both houses of Congress met in New York, which is very unprecedented, almost unprecedented, to have them meet outside of Washington. And I got a call from people in Congress, I think people arranging this meeting, this memorial service, asking me, the poet laureate, if I'd write a poem. Well, we now have a sense of what I write about, which is walking the dog and thinking about that squirrel's going to outlive me and that kind of thing. And I thought the topic was just way too big for me. Like the COVID is way too big for me, but I wrote these two little poems about that. I can't write a big one about that. But I heard my, so I told them I couldn't do it, but I'd read something. I'd read Whitman maybe, but, and they were disappointed. And I thought, so I woke up one morning, I thought, well, my mother would be really disappointed too. I heard her saying, you know, get off the bench and get to work. So I had two things made it possible. One is I thought I could write an elegy, just a poem for the dead and not worry about geopolitical ramifications and the attack and all those larger issues. So it's an elegy for the dead. And I could work my way, since I'm grieving people, I could work my way through the poem by using the alphabet and having each letter be represented by one of the fallen people. And so I wrote it in a couple of hours. And then the hard part was reading it before Congress. I mean, I managed to keep myself together, but it did say something interesting about poetry, because when I started to read it, it had been preceded, of course, by lots of other speakers. When I began to read the poem, it begins with talking about a rain at night and a breeze, and there's a glaze on the windows. And people looked up like your dog there, cocking their heads, like they had no idea what was being said here, because it wasn't political language. It was poetic language that used imagery. And so it was a good kind of test that of the difference between those two languages. And then various senators and representatives, you know, were attentive at various degrees. Senator Moynihan was the most attentive of all. He was a poetry lover for sure.
It's so interesting how the language of poetry can reach the hearts of people in ways that other writings somehow cannot.
Well, I like to say the poetry is the history of the human heart. You know, we have lots of histories of warfare and treaties and inventions and exploration. But poetry, going back to Sumerian or Roman times, is really the story of human emotion. And those emotions don't change. What changes is the metaphors and the imagery and the rhythms of the poem, which make the poem unique. But basically, we're wired to the same things that people were wired to thousands of years ago.
Billy, now would you read for us the names?
Sure. And the little note is under the title is "For the Victims of September 11th and Their Survivors." Yesterday, I lay awake in the palm of the night. A fine rain stole in, unhelped by any breeze. And when I saw the silver glaze on the windows, I started with Ackerman, as it happened, then Baxter and Calabro, Davis and Eberling, names falling into place as droplets fell through the dark, names printed on the ceiling of the night, names slipping around a watery bend, 26 willows on the banks of a stream. In the morning, I walked out barefoot among thousands of flowers, heavy with dew, like the eyes of tears, and each had a name, Fiori, inscribed on a yellow petal, then Gonzales and Hahn, Ishikawa and Jenkins, names written in the air and stitched into the cloth of the day, a name under a photograph taped to a mailbox, monogram on a torn shirt, I see you spelled out on storefront windows and on the bright, unfurled awnings of this city. I say the syllables as I turn a corner, Kelly and Lee, Medina, Nardella, and O'Connor. When I peer into the woods, I see a thick tangle where letters are hidden, as in a puzzle concocted for children, Parker and Quigley, in the twigs of an ash, Rizzo, Schubert, Torres, and Upton, secrets in the boughs of an ancient maple. Names written in the pale sky, names rising in the updraft amid buildings, names silent in stone or cried out behind a door, names blown over the earth and out to sea. In the evening, weakening light, the last swallows, a boy on a lake lifts his oars. A woman by a window puts a match to a candle, and the names are outlined on the rose clouds, Vanacore and Wallace. Let X stand, if it can, for those unfound. Then Young and Zeminski, the final jolt of Z. Names etched into the head of a pin, one name spanning a bridge, another undergoing a tunnel, a blue name needled into the skin. Names of citizens, workers, mothers and fathers, the bright-eyed daughter, the quick son. Alphabet of names in green rows in a field. Names in the small tracks of birds, names lifted from a hat or balanced on the tip of the tongue. Names wheeled into the dim warehouse of memory. So many names, there is barely room on the walls of the heart.
Billy, your mother would have been proud.
Thank you.
Truly. I want to ask you what you are thankful for this year.
Well, I think that I'm still alive, not just because I'm older now, but because of the circumstances, I'm still pretty healthy and alive. I'm thankful for everyday experience. I'm thankful for having a loving wife and also just the experience of walking around. I think we forget so much and we get tied up in our routines. But it's really just that cliche of stopping the smell of the roses. But there are things everywhere. You don't have to have an actual rose, just the daily experience. Just yesterday at 7:27, yesterday evening, we were on a New Smyrna beach and we watched the rocket launch. This phosphorescent, it lit up the sky with this phosphorescent brightness, and that settled down. And then it became like an ember, you know, at the end of a lit cigarette, and then it disappeared. That's a little too much for me to write about because it's, you know, it's too much in itself. I'd rather pick a small thing and examine it. But I think gratitude is, attention is really a form of gratitude. So looking at things without any purpose. Also, spending a half an hour a day doing nothing. That's something that's very hard to do these days. I mean, it sounds easy because you think, well, I do a lot of, lots of the time I'm doing nothing. Well, not really. You're doing something almost all the time. If you actually try to do nothing for half an hour, something will happen. You'll access something within.
Maybe write a poem.
Maybe even write a poem.
Billy, would you finally please read for us The Garland, which is on the back of your new book?
I'd be happy to, Diane. The Garland. I would like to be laid to rest in a big tomb topped by the stone figure of an angel who appears to have landed there in order to sob forevermore, her face buried in her bent arm, one folded wing hanging by her side. Then, whenever I found the time to visit my own grave, after approaching with slow, respectful steps, I would place around her rough neck the garland of wildflowers that I knitted, then run back to the car, laughing and immortal.
I love it. Billy, what do you consider a good death?
A good death? I don't think there is a... Well, I suppose just, you know, falling asleep in your, falling, I mean, dying in your, rolling over and having a nice dream and that. But I was thinking the other day, the odd thing about death is that once you're dead, you don't know a lot of things. I mean, if you believe, and I'm working on a poem about this, if you believe in the afterlife, and in most religions, there is some inclusion of a life after death. And if there isn't an afterlife, just say hypothetically, you'll never be disappointed because you'll be dead. Do you see what I mean? You'll never see, you'll never have this, oh, there's no afterlife. No, that doesn't come because you're dead. So no believer will be disappointed. And same goes for the atheists and the skeptics and the agnostics. They'll be dead too. So they won't be able to say, well, I told you so.
Are you a believer?
I'm a skeptic, I'd say. I think, in a way, I would picture God saying, I gave you all this. I believe in a creator of some kind, something that we can't really conceive of. But I think the creator says, I gave you all this, this earth and these planets and this sun and all that. And you want more? you want to live forever? No. I live forever. You know, I'm the one who lives forever. Your life is on Earth. And that's why I think life on Earth is so important, because there's no planet B, as they say.
Billy Collins, you have tears in your eyes. What brought those?
It's the Irishness in me, yeah. I'm an easy crier.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Well, it's a great pleasure always to be with you, Diane, and I hope we get together again. I think this is the third time we met, and that's not enough for me. So I want to see you again.
And I you, and we will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That was my November conversation with Billy Collins, U.S. Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2003. Whale Day and Other Poems is his 14th collection of poetry. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.